The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a Swangled
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, Vigilante.tv, now on Rumble, or you are listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate the support. If you want to connect with us, the website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can find me on Twitter at Macroaggressions. Thanks to the sponsors. They make the show happen. EMP Shield is building a fantastic EMP shielding device that will protect your home against solar flares, EMPs, lightning strikes, all kinds of things. You can get it to work. It'll work on your home, on your car, on your motorhome or boat if you have one. If you have a generator, it'll work on that as well. It'll connect with just four wires, like a household circuit breaker, and it will install easily. You can do it yourself, or you can have an electrician come over and do it for you. There's installation videos. It's pretty easy. I tell you what, if you are thinking about getting something like this, just do this. Go to empshield.com, read up about it, see what you think. And if you find something that you like, use the promo code MACRO to save yourself a little bit of money. empshield.com is the place to go. And also thanks to the crew over at C60 Purple Power. They're making the best batch of C60 out there. If you've never heard of C60 before, it is the most powerful antioxidant known. It's hundreds of times more powerful than anything out there on the market. It will help to maximize the efficiency of cells in producing energy. It may also help to provide cellular protection against the many toxic environmental factors that we face. I'll tell you what, the guys that discovered it, they wound up winning the Nobel Prize in science. It's kind of a big deal. Do this, go to shopc60.com, read up about it, see what you think. If you find something you like, the promo code is MACRO. Use that to save yourself a little bit of money. Now we have to do the song and dance. These statements and products have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, prevent, or mitigate any disease. See, I did it. That is C60. So go to shopc60.com and see if you think it's right for you. Well, I'll tell you what, not only am I excited about this, I've been so excited about this episode that we've been texting about it all week. So without further ado, he is the producer of A Noble Lie. He is the producer of A State of Mind, The Psychology of Control. Let me butcher that. And also Shadow Ring. I'm sure you guys have seen that. Ladies and gentlemen, from Free Minds Film, Chris Emery. Chris, good to see you. Holy moly, where do we even start? I've wanted to talk to you for a long, long time. Ricky Verandas, my partner at Union of the Unwanted, sent me your information. And as soon as he did, what do you know? That night I see you on Union of the Unwanted, just like magic before I even... So we're already on the same wavelength. So thanks for coming to the show. I'm excited to get into this. Man, how the hell do you even get started in this line of work, making these films? These are the films that everybody wants to see, but like... How'd you get started on this?
I was a photographer with Big Ten Football, and I basically that got my exposure, my entree into media, and literally working on the sidelines with colleagues in radio, television, and film. And after 8.5 years, I decided to. It was at the cusp of going from old school SLR, the silver oxide negatives, and decided not to make the jump into digital, and I wanted to work in front of the camera. So I had some friends that said, hey, you got to list with an agent. Long story short, was doing bit parts in commercials, print work. But my passion, and I could sense this after probably about a year, I wanted to work behind the camera. I really like the mechanics and just being a project manager, taking the 1,000-foot view and bringing the whole team together. And I think that's was my forte early on. And so I worked on biographical documentaries, training videos, short films with a small production studio in Fort Worth, Texas. And then it was, I want to say late 1999, a friend of mine invited me to look at raw footage from the Oklahoma City bombing. And he says, I think we need to make a film on this. And I says, what's this we stuff? I says, I bought the official story. I could care two hoots and a holler about it. He says, no, you got to see this. So after 3 hours of watching the raw footage, I says, wow. There's stuff here that makes no sense compared to the official narrative. And, 6 months later, I'm making plans to move to New Mexico for a year. And that's where I really cleared my head, tried to put an outline together. And then January of 2003, I hit the ground running in Oklahoma City. So,
wow,
there was.
What were your feelings when you saw the Oklahoma City bombing? Because I remember where I was, and this is going to be kind of funny for people because they've always known me as being bald. But at that time, I remember I had just gotten out of college and I had long hair, like long surfer hair. And
where's the CGI screen?
I know. Somebody will have some fun with it for sure. But I just made the decision to cut it all off. So I just cut. And I remember I was sitting in the chair of the barber and they were cutting my hair and he was saying, just makes me sick what happened to those kids, you know. It just makes it the fact that there were children in there, I just want to throw up, you know, this whole thing. And it was like breaking news and it was on all the TVs. And so I remember having the same feeling that the barber had, which was, it's always bad no matter what, but it's particularly bad when you knew that there were a lot of children in this building. And was there a daycare in the building, or was it a daycare setup?
It was on the second floor. I was on the east side of the building on the second floor.
Yeah.
There were go ahead.
No, well, I mean, I you know, so I had no understanding of what the media was. I had no knowledge of false flags. I didn't understand this. I was fresh out of college. I didn't really know anything, but I knew I was upset about it. And I knew I was emotionally, it hurt me, but I had no connections to Oklahoma City or anything like that. And then it falls out of the news cycle after a couple of weeks. And then you go on about your business. And it's not until many, many years later that I thought, that I came to the understanding that 9/11 was not as it appears. And then that leads you down the rabbit hole. Well, if this was a lie, what else was a lie? And then you eventually wind up at Oklahoma City. And when you wind up at Oklahoma City, you'll have the same reaction that we both had, which was, you know, how dare they do this with kids in there? And so what was your thought? You were sort of oblivious to this at that time too, I would assume.
Well, I you know, they say you remember moments and not days, but I remember when it happened. I was working for my dad. He got an office at Zilker Park in central Austin. I remember coming into the break room that morning, and it was about 9:15, about 10 minutes after the bombing. Anyway, I go in there and the secretaries are crying, and I said, "What's going on?" And I looked down and he had a black and white TV on a small coffee table, and I said, "Take a look." And I thought, holy cow, you know, a third of that building was just literally detached, like an alien craft just sucked it and displaced it about 3 to 4 blocks north where it stood. And I thought, this is horrible. And 10 minutes to realize what was going on. And it was horrible, but I didn't register it as anything that I wanted to do as far as a film. I was still working in front of the camera at that time, doing, bit parts of commercials and made for TV films in Austin. Great film market there. So anyway, here's a really odd story that real quick. It was about 7 weeks later that my dad had a big state convention, and it was at the Hyatt Regency at DFW Airport. So we rent out a Ryder truck from a rental agency in South Austin, not far from the airport. And the old guy behind the counter looked at us. He says, "You want to rent one of these?" And I said, "Sure." You know, we're 7 miles, 7 hour drive south of Oklahoma City. And, you know, we could carry, we didn't put two and two together. He says, "Okay." So I'm driving the truck full of his office equipment, printing, you know, machines and all of the stuff for the convention. It was a 5-day event. And this old couple pulls up next to me. I'm just tooling up I-35 to go to Dallas. Old couple pulls up to me, and the husband is sitting on the passenger side, hunched over, and he flips me the bird. And I'm thinking, what the hell is his problem? Just, again, didn't put two and two together. It was about a year later, it dawned on me. I thought, holy cow, I'm driving a Ryder truck literally 7 weeks after the bombing.
Right.
And it was just that association. It's like, what the hell are you doing with this truck? Plain as Dallas, you know, big old Ryder logo on the side. Come to find out, and it wasn't until 4 years later, like I said, that I saw the raw footage. And it was just an unbelievable opportunity, and I couldn't turn back. Yeah. It was just amazing. So
you start about, how would you even start with something like this? I would imagine that you're probably not going to get a ton of cooperation from anybody that you'd really want to talk to, like the FBI or maybe the media there. Maybe you might find a person one off here or there, somebody that's left the job, but you're sure not going to get a ton of cooperation from the cover-up squad. So how did you go about even starting the process of making A Noble Lie?
Well, what I did before I moved to Oklahoma City, even Albuquerque, and that was a year before I moved to Oklahoma City, I was doing research for about 2.5 years. And my boss at the small studio I was working at Fort Worth, he says, "Look," he says, "I know you're interested in this case." He says, "You have to set a line of demarcation, 6 months or $6,000. Whatever you come up to first, that's when you decide what direction you want to move in." And he says, "In the meantime, you find out everything you can that supports the official narrative. If you can't, then that means you need to make an independent documentary." Well, he was right. And the only thing I could find was that, yes, 168 people, including 3 unborn kids, were brutally murdered. Nothing I did to research supported the official narrative. And I thought, wow, all these red flags are popping up. Like, okay, obviously McVeigh doing it by himself didn't make any sense. And I had a background, and I mentioned on the Union of the Unwanted, with 2 years and as a civil engineer student, undergrad at University of Wisconsin-Madison. The physical structure, how it was damaged, made no sense with ANFO. And then I started establishing contacts, 14 round trips to Oklahoma City, a former architect with the architect firm that designed the building, retired law enforcement, canine officer who ended up. Anyway, we ended up interviewing him on the film, 326 interviews that would come about in the next 7 years. And out of those, we interviewed about 40, and I think about 28 of those made it on the film. So is this a process of elimination? Okay, do you have, what direction are you going? Where are all the arrows pointing to? Toward the official narrative? Not only no, but hell no. It was pointing to a completely different direction, to a completely different story. And that's the direction we had to move. Yeah. So it's just common sense. And any responsible filmmaker, there were 3 things we avoided. attributed to, based upon, and inspired by. We went ahead and we got the solid documentation. This isn't some fluff Hollywood documentary that, you know, they'll make a ton of money on and the big studios will fund. We were an independent film company that literally five of us emptied our savings. Two guys got second mortgages on the home. And we just bared down, stayed focused, kept our eye on the ball, and we wanted to find out what really happened.
And did you find out what really happened?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was horrific. We found out, to the best of our knowledge, and 95% of the documentation that the movie's based on is actually with local, county, state, and federal law enforcement, all the way from eyewitness testimony that was provided to us by lawyers at the and legals at the U.S. Prosecutor's Office. White paper written by the Oklahoma City Police Department that literally solved the case in 4 days. And that was quashed. That never came out. Federal government says, no, we don't need your baloney. Well, it wasn't baloney. It was solid. Former bike officers with the Oklahoma Highway State Patrol, former members of the governor's security detail. Frank Keating was governor at the time. They came forward when word got around fast. When I moved there in 03, and I'm not taking all the credit here, Charlie, there were seven people that really helped me out. I was helping at least lead everybody in the right direction that we wanted to go. We knew that the official narrative was complete garbage. So why waste your time on that? But the other 75 volunteers, and out of those, we formed a core group of 15. And out of that, seven on the film crew came together. So again, it was just a process of elimination, who was available, who had the expertise and the, you know, the competency to put a film like this together. And yeah, 12 to 18 people were involved. McVeigh was working for the CIA, who was on the payroll for, the best of our knowledge, at least 2 years, possibly 2.5 years. Nichols was straight out framed. There was evidence that was manufactured by the U.S. Justice Department and the prosecutor's office in Washington, not in Oklahoma City. We found very few people at the FBI field office in OKC and the prosecutor's office that were willing to work with their counterparts in Washington. And to put that in context, Charlie, can you imagine having your best friends, family members, loved ones, law enforcement officers and their loved ones, and every, like I said, local, county, state, and federal, to have them brutally murdered or just come within an inch of their life, and then being asked to lie about that? The big shoulders are coming in from Washington and basically giving them the marching orders. It's like, they're getting the, you know, the big finger. It's like, no, we're not going to, these are our loved ones. These are our locals. These are the people that we know day in and day out. We're not going to lie about this. They were the ones that came forward through either emails, sending us, you know, packages with no return addresses, or just contacting us at 7-Elevens or random encounters at dinner and said, look, this is the information I want to pass on to you. Please, it's already been vetted. And we had a triple checked, obviously, with our, you know, our staff and a couple of detectives that were retired that helped us out. But the point is that, again, all of the arrows, which way are they pointing? And it's in a completely different direction than what the Justice Department was telling us. And it was just layer upon layer upon layer of bald-faced lies. Wow. And we couldn't go that way. We wanted to make a film based on the truth.
Yeah. So we had our suspicions that Timothy McVeigh was a sheep dip intelligence operative. I think that, you know, I think I had always assumed McVeigh and Terry Nichols were a team, right? You know, I mean, I didn't think that they were. I didn't buy the story that was set up, but I had no reason to think that they weren't working together. But you say Terry Nichols had nothing to do with it.
Well, what they did get him on, and he should have been out of federal prison within 5 years, that he failed to notify the government of the conspiracy. But it was the physical evidence that they literally concocted against him that was horrendous. I mean, there was so much exculpatory evidence, both in the McVeigh and Nichols trial. Nichols should have been, in fact, he came one count. They had to have all 12 members of the jury, but he came within one vote of being completely exonerated of all charges. Can you imagine? I mean, there was that close to saying, hey, the jury says, no, you're not going to prison. And McVeigh, they did go they served in basic training at Fort Riley for the U.S. Army in Kansas together. But Terry Nichols, a lot of people don't know this, the intellect and the maturity of like an eighth grader at the time. It was arrested development. He was very easily to be influenced, and he was a go along, come along guy. And he didn't have the fortitude or the common sense or whatever to tell the government what was going on. What we found out, and this is, God, I tell you, Charlie, talk about going down a rabbit hole. But the FBI screwed up so bad in Waco that they wanted to enumerate themselves along with the ATF. And the Oklahoma City case was actually supposed to happen the night before, on April 18th at 9 o'clock, 12 hours prior to the actual detonation. And it was Larry Potts, who was number two at the FBI, who also had a hand in the Ruby Ridge travesty and the Waco travesty. He was McVeigh's handler. Now, let that soak in for a few minutes. How can you have number two under Louis Free handling McVeigh for what we knew 4 months before the Oklahoma City bombing? I mean, that's complicity in the FBI to the max. You know, and Larry Potts said that and this is according to Terry Nichols, and McVeigh told him that Larry Potts told McVeigh that Potts wanted a body count. And McVeigh says, no. He says, I'm a professional assassin. I smuggle drugs. There's no way in hell I'm killing kids. We drew the line. And Potts says, no, we got you over the barrel and weapons charges, drug smuggling. You're pretty much going to do what we tell you. That never came out, obviously. Can you imagine that being told to the jury? And yeah, so that's what we had to work with.
Well, I'm not surprised, because Louis Free, who was the head of the FBI at the time, is a Lesser Kell member, which is like a the Committee of 300, like a dangerous group of right-leaning neocon scumbags. And that's what they do. You know, upon further review, I'm not too surprised looking back on these things that somebody like that would be involved. But it's an interesting story to hear that you know, Tim McVeigh had, you know, that there were lines that he didn't want to cross. Sure. But of course, you know, when the feds tell you, you know, they've got you, then they've got you. Of course, he should have understood the game. I don't know. Was this part of a much broader plan to paint this move, like the, I don't know, how would you describe them? The
neo-Nazi.
Militia group. That's the word I was looking for. The separatist militia groups, the Ruby Ridges, the Waco types, as the enemy, as the bad guys. And now here they are, domestic terrorists looking to get revenge for Waco and Ruby Ridge by doing this to the poor, unsuspecting guy.
28 years later, here we are, and Merrick Garland, again, was a special prosecutor with the Oklahoma City case. And I see it coming back on steroids. What happened in Oklahoma City and what happened with J6 was, I cried that morning. I says, oh my God, here we go all over again. You know, when I saw that the provocateurs, I could tell, I mean, even on TV, it's like, oh, hell yeah. There must be at least 50 and not 100 in that crowd. You don't go from a good meeting, well-meaning Trump supporter to mowing down fences and beating the crap out of the Capitol and busting windows. Anyway, that's another conversation for another time.
Yeah.
But it was a pattern that repeated itself. What we found out that McVeigh, of course, he was on General Schwarzkopf's security detail in the first Persian Gulf War. He was a tank gunner. Mm-hmm. He could take you out, literally cut you in half, 800 yards down range with a 50 cal. He got two medals of commendation. A lot of people aren't aware of this either. While he was in custody at the federal courthouse in downtown Denver awaiting federal trial, they had a special room made for him. It was like a Motel 6 room, literally 40, 50 feet walk from the courtroom. They had a cot. You know, he had a little TV, his magazines, got 3 squares a day. And security was a lot easier to deal, walk down the hallway versus transporting him from the county lockup. Anyway, while he was there, he got two medals of commendations in the brown wood box with the purple velvet, and commending him for his great job he did with Schwarzkopf. So how do you go to that, to being a terrorist and blowing up a building full of people and kids? No sense. Complete disconnect on the chain of logic there. And that's when we found out that, yeah, he wrote a letter to his sister and said, yeah, I've been working for the CIA for 2.5 years prior to the bombing. He didn't assassinate the top state of heads of state. He would go 3-4 down, maybe the limousine driver or, you know, the maid or the line keeper, whatever, just to send a signal up the flagpole like, okay, you're getting out of line. This is what's going to happen to your family. That was McVeigh's job. And gotcha. He'd go home, had access to a private jet. He'd go home, pick up his dry cleaning, make his meal, and be ready for the next assignment. That's the Tim McVeigh that we're dealing with.
Okay. So a CIA assassin. Now, we don't know this, right? Because we're just the general public. But the FBI gets their building blown up, and the guy that does it is a CIA asset. Does this put the CIA and the FBI at odds with one another? I mean, I'm sure they're already sort of fighting over resources.
Well, the irony is that in the 4.5 months leading up to the bombing, they weren't communicating with each other because they had budget, turf wars, ego wars. ATF, CIA, and the FBI were at Ellwood City, that encampment, right on the Oklahoma-Arkansas border, about 40 miles outside of southeast of Tulsa. And there were provocateurs and informants in there that neither agency of the three knew about. That's how compartmentalized they were. And then, of course, Andreas Strassmeier, his name comes up. Why? Because his dad, Gunther Strassmeier, was the former chief of staff of Helmut Kohl, the former premier of Germany, who was specifically asked by Al Gore, vice president at the time of the bombing, to bring Andreas Strassmeier in to infiltrate these quote-unquote militia groups because they wanted to quash the neo-Nazi movement in the U.S., which, for all intents and purposes, really didn't even exist. So it's this snake weaving through the grass, trying to get this agenda, concoct something that didn't exist. And here we are 28 years later, and it's just, it's completely out of whack. It's out of control. And you have a president that's, a former president that's due to go to the hopefully not, but indicted and possibly going to prison based on, excuse me, Charlie, based on pure unadulterated bullshit. That's all it is.
Yeah. Well, but if history is repeating itself, and it certainly feels like it might be, are we not at a situation where we're ready for another Oklahoma City?
Yeah, that's it. You know, and when I saw 9/11, I says, oh, hell no, this is crap. And then J6, you know.
Yeah.
It's a pattern. So,
all right. So the building gets blown up, with the Ryder truck bomb, the ammonium nitrate bomb that everyone went, really? You can make a bomb out of fertilizer? And some people went, well, yeah, you can, but I don't know if it would look like that. Right. So there's questions about the building. There's questions about the way the explosives went off. There's a whole lot of questions. There's a third person that we're looking for, and then we're not looking for the third person. Then that guy kind of disappeared. There's legislation ready to go immediately afterwards, right? All sorts of reductions of your civil liberties, things like that. So we had everything, and we have Bill Clinton in the White House, of course, and that's never good because he's always up to to destroying the country from the inside. So we have a recipe for disaster, and we had a lot of people starting to ask questions, but this was kind of before. This was really before. It was before 9/11. It was before these bullshit wars in the Middle East, we'd just come off of the first World Trade Center bombing, which was kind of a dud. Didn't really do much. It killed a couple people, but it didn't really have the body count that they were looking for. And then you say that the word from above is we need a body count, right? 9/11 the first time around didn't do it. Oklahoma City sure will. And then what do you know? You get this body count. But almost immediately, there seems to be some sort of questions with the story locally. There's a lot of local reporters asking questions. There's a lot of police asking questions. You have, of course, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You should be investigating this. And then they're getting stonewalled on some of the things that... So how long did it take before this went from, oh my God, this is a tragedy, to we better start asking further questions about this so-called tragedy?
Well, it's a good question. Charles Key, who was the head of the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee, he was a state representative serving at the state capitol. It was about 15 miles as a crow flies north of the Murrah Building. His former secretary, and I'm going to walk you through this real quick, make it as quick as I can. His secretary at the Capitol resigned a year before the bombing and took a job with the federal government. She was killed the morning of the bombing. So Charles knew her parents, obviously, and a brother in the family, very close. They went to church together. 2 weeks after the bombing, Charles told me this. Charles is the rising star in the state house. He's on the education subcommittee, tax reform committee. He's basically the golden child for the governor, among other handpicked senators and reps, invited to lunch once a week with the governor. So his decision, and it was the family that came up to him 2 weeks after the bombing on a Sunday, and said, look, we're getting one story from the FBI. County sheriff is telling us something different, Oklahoma City Police, and the State Highway Patrol. He says, you're a rep in our district, District 90 on the western side of Oklahoma City. Can you impanel an independent committee, aside from the official federal investigation, to come up with the answers? And he sat down with his wife that afternoon on their living room couch, and he says to his wife, Janice, great family, by the way. I've known him since June of 2001. Anyway, he says that was the time, that was the minute in that discussion that he decided that his political career was going to go down the toilet, because he was going to go an end run on this thing and go completely independent of the FBI and start asking some hard questions based on our good eyewitness testimony and the evidence. So to answer your question, we had a lot of good people, and I want to qualify this, Charlie. Like I said, local, county, state, and federal law enforcement, there are a lot of good people, all the way from IT to the secretaries to some of the investigators with the FBI field office, that came forward and gave us information that they were told to destroy. And they said, not only no, but hell no. This story hasn't been told. We need to save this. And by God, some of them lost their jobs over it. I'm not going to name names. But if it wasn't for them and the county sheriff and the police department and K-9 Rescue and the bomb squad from Oklahoma County, and then, of course, you know, all of the governor's detail, we would have never known that information. So wow. The FBI was held accountable to this day. They're still held accountable. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. Well, and there weren't, you know, listen, not everybody that's involved, not everybody that yeah. has a role in this is the bad guy. There's a good guy. No. There's Officer Terrence Yankee, right? Yep. He started to ask questions. He started to kind of put the pieces together, and then something very inconsistent with reality happened to him. Can we tell the story of what happened to Officer Yankee?
He was Terry Yankee was a 7.5-year veteran of the Oklahoma City Police Department, served in the first Persian Gulf War as an MP, did his time, came back, and went back. He was actually, I want to say, he was at the county sheriff's west of Oklahoma City, different county. And then he got on with the Oklahoma City Police Department. So the morning of the bombing, he's issuing a traffic ticket in a black and white squad car, steps out of his car, hears the explosions, goes back into the, and hauls ass 4 blocks to the crime scene, pulls out 8 people. At this time, he had a bad back, but the adrenaline kicked in, and he's pulling out a guy twice his size. After everything had calmed down later that evening, he could barely walk. I mean, he felt his injuries coming back. And he was about ready to have back surgery like a month or so later. He was due. But anyway, what he saw, the unexploded ordnance, and before they had the security perimeter established, he was able to get in, pulling these people out. And he saw there were unexploded ordnance devices, that the narrative that was coming out within 20 minutes of the bombing to 4 hours to 6 hours, he said it was not true, according to what he saw. He wrote up a 13.5 page report. His commanding officer, Lieutenant Joanne Randall, who I will still hold her feet to the fire today, if she has an issue with this, then she could talk to me on the phone and I'll tell her why I'm going to rake her over the coals on this, told him to cut it down to 1.5 pages. And he said no. He basically told her to go take a flying leap. He's not going to lie for anybody. He said, I show up every day with my sidearm and my badge. I'm proud to serve the police department. I'm not lying for anybody. And basically told her to get lost. Well, he was harassed for the next year and 3 weeks after the bombing. He was found in a farm field 2 miles from the front gate of the El Reno Federal Penitentiary. Oddly enough, where McVeigh was remanded into custody until he was sent off to Denver. And he was brutally murdered, stabbed in his car, walked 1.5 miles, and then shot execution style in the back of the head with a low caliber bullet. Marks were still there, and they had ligature marks on his wrists and on his legs. So he was hogtied and shot and left for dead in the farm field. It was horrendous. I had a chance to walk out within about 30 yards of where they found the body. And I was brought to tears. This is, that's no way for anybody to leave this earth, you know, let alone a distinguished police officer.
No, and he had told his family earlier that they're coming. Yeah. They're going to get me.
He was vice squad, so he knew. He served on the DARE program and served on vice squad undercover, so he knew surveillance tactics. He knew that somebody was following them. And the bank vault that he had a lot of his evidence stored at in El Reno, which was about 30 miles west of Oklahoma City. After he died, the FBI came in and badged the way in and basically told the bank manager to open it up, and they absconded with it, and nobody's ever seen it since then.
Ooh. Wow. Yeah. There was also another guy who is a common denominator in a couple things. This is engineer Gene Corley, right? He was involved in Waco, Oklahoma City, and 9/11, right? This guy, he seems to be the cover-up guy from an engineering standpoint, right? He's the guy that comes in and says, no, this is totally normal that when a Ryder truck explosive goes off, it takes off half this building, even though it's should theoretically go out in all directions. Instead, it just went one direction. So he's the guy that basically, this is the structural engineer equivalent to the guy, to the coroner who says that he died from suicide by shooting himself on the back of the head twice, right? This is the guy they bring in every time. What was Gene Corley doing at the, what did he do to perpetuate the mainstream story about this?
He was the cleanup guy. Stephen Jones and the defense team sued to have access to the crime scene. Well, they wouldn't let him any closer than 2.5 blocks. Well, how are you supposed to get any credible evidence or collect any, you know, credible photos if you're 2.5 blocks away, you know, using a telephoto lens and hearsay and conjecture on testimony from the cleanup crew? So Corley comes in, and it was the same service that was hired to demolish, finish the demolition of the building so they could haul it away, that would end up doing the 9/11 demolition. So his whole...
and hauling that stuff away, too.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Fresh Kills landfill, and God only knows to China or where else. But Corley came in and headed up a team that gave the Justice Department and the prosecution a whitewash official narrative story. They didn't ask any questions on the interior ordnance or the anomalies on the literal amount of damage to the building within 20 minutes after the bombing. Nowhere could have been remotely caused by ANFO. Just glossed that over, ignored it as though it didn't happen. He's criminal. He should still be held criminally liable for helping the cover up and destruction of relevant evidence in that case. I have no respect for the guy at all.
In what we've seen in the past with these events, 9/11 in particular, is that a lot of times after an act of terrorism like this, in which mistakes were made, as Rumsfeld would say, these people that should rightly be fired for their incompetence tend to get promoted. Were there people that with the Oklahoma City situation that wound up getting promoted, maybe even like out of Oklahoma City and into Washington, D.C.? Oh, I mean, this seems like something
we call them it was kind of a dark gallows humor joke. We call them the Dirty 30, including the governor of Oklahoma at the time, Frank Keating, was promoted to be head of a insurance commission in Washington, getting paid $1 million a year. It's like, really, Frank, you have no background in insurance. He graduated from the FBI in Quantico, I believe, with George Bush in that whole class, senior. Had no background in insurance, but there is a job waiting for him, slotted in D.C. Sam Gonzalez, the police chief of the Oklahoma City Police Department. Again, I wish I could have 15 minutes to sit down with these guys in an interrogation room and just verbally dress them down. Knowing what I know about them, he helped cover up the investigation and was actually on the crime scene of Terry Yickey's murder scene with Bob Ricks, who was the FBI station chief at the time in Oklahoma City, special agent in charge. And he was relieved of his duties by Louis Free. Anyway, Sam Gonzalez gets promoted, and I believe he had actually worked for the FBI field office in Dallas. So, yes, to answer your question, and they gave each other raises. They're patting each other on the back. I'm thinking, what a sick son of a bitch. How do you do this, you know, with a clear conscience? So,
yeah, this is awful.
Yeah.
We've also got, this almost sounds like a glitch in the Matrix, but we've got in the the weekend leading up to 9/11, we have Mohammed Atta and the so-called terrorists that are on the 9/11 flights.
Yes.
The weekend before that took place on a Tuesday, September 11th. We have them.
See this dossier? This is all the information we gathered over 4.5 years. I'm right here, folks. Hard copy.
Okay.
that's basically like a set of seven copies. So that's not the only one.
Those guys that are supposed to be the terrorists flying the planes into buildings in New York City just a few days before the event are in Oklahoma City, making a lot of noise, getting themselves thrown out of bars, getting themselves thrown out of museums, almost as if acting in a way in which it is unforgettable that you would have an interaction with them. So therefore, later on, when someone says, did you see anything funny? You go, well, there was this one group of Muslim guys that were acting particularly funny and unusual, drinking tons of alcohol, getting tossed out of the museum? Revolutionary History Museum or something?
Well, no, actually, and I'm going to show this to you. This is a badge. That's the Oklahoma City National Memorial Museum. This is the badge from the volunteer that basically blew the whistle on what happened. So let's rewind the tape, as they say in film parlance.
Yeah.
Go back to Thursday, the Thursday before 9/11. 9/11 is on a Tuesday. So we're looking at Monday's the 10th, Sunday's the 9th, and let's see here, Saturday's the 8th, Friday's the 7th, so it'll be Thursday the 6th. And so it's mid-afternoon. Mohammed Atta and four of his accomplices would later be cited that next day at a country western bar. Anyway, they're at the Oklahoma City National Memorial Museum, which is literally 240 feet to the north of where the Murrah Building stood. It was a former Journal Record building, a big print shop that did a local business paper. Hold on one second here. I apologize. Trying out the new technology here. So they see the this docent sees them, and they're carrying on and yelling at each and just carrying on and being very boisterous, but it's in a Middle Eastern accent, not Spanish, not Portuguese, not French. She says, "Yeah, this she could recognize it. Her daughter worked for actually Intel, the Tinker Air Force Base, and studied foreign linguistics." And anyway, so when she described her daughter, she says, "Yeah, that's of Middle Eastern dialect." So the next day, they show up at Graham's Country Western Bar in the afternoon, and Mohammed Atta is there with four of his guys, who would later be identified as four of the accomplices of the 19 hijackers, two of which the passports were stolen, and they were still alive in Britain for some reason. I mean, just there were body doubles here. There was definitely two teams working this, what we could deduce. And Mohammed Atta pulls a knife on one of the regular patrons and the girlfriend, and the patrons get kicked out of Mohammed Atta, and his four accomplices are still allowed to be in the bar. Well, the bartender that witnessed all this says, no, that's not protocol. Somebody pulls a knife, whether it be a switchblade or whatever, out. You're hitting the asphalt in 10 seconds because he backed up as a bouncer. All right. So the following day, they come back Saturday and they order five drinks, one for each of them, at $3 a shot. And it was of a whiskey. They asked for a Dewar's, but they didn't serve that. So he gave them an off-brand whiskey, a well drink. But there was no tip on the receipt. And bartenders remember that. You don't stiff bartenders.
I was a bartender for 7 years. I remember.
So you understand. Oh, yeah. So you understand. So all of these red flags are popping up. Knife being pulled on a patron. Stiffing on the... And here's the third one. When they were ready to settle out the account, he's looking at the card. And he says, oh, crap, this thing expired at the end of March of 2001. $15 is $15. He'd have to pull it out of his pocket to pay the tab. He ran it through just for grins, and it went through just fine. He says, in the 18 years he bartended, he says, he's never had an expired card go through. Either they're settled up in cash or, jokingly, you're washing the dishes in the back room for the next 3 days.
Right.
So he said, yeah, that was the final straw. And then he said, there's something really off with these guys. Well, they ran that tab at 2:38 in the morning. I've got a copy here of that Sunday before 9/11, never to be seen again. All right. So gets here another glitch in the matrix. What happens to Saturday after 9/11? So you got Tuesday it happens, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 4 days after 9/11, a sixth accomplice comes back into the bar who the bartender and the It was the barback and the bouncer were solid. I talked to them completely separate, and they identified it as one of the three hijackers that wore glasses. And I've got them in the lineup here. Anyway, this hijacker tries to pick a fight with our bartender friend. And there was kind of undertone conversation about 9/11. The six hijackers has got upset because he says, yeah, my friends were killed in that. It's like, what are you talking about? Officially, you're one of them that was supposed to be killed. Complete disconnect. It was like living in the Twilight Zone. The bartender says, there's something really weird here. But Graham's, we found out, was known for hanging out for the spooks and basically undercover vice squad coming in from Dallas, Oklahoma City, Minneapolis, big drug trade along I-35 corridor. They'd come there to kind of loosen up and have a few drinks. And it was also a huge money laundering operation. He said, oh, yeah, Graham's hadn't made a profit in 12 years prior to 9/11. They purposely lost money. And I'm thinking, that makes no sense. Why are you in business to lose money? Well, it's consistent with, and I sent you an article to the connections with that Wiley Post Airport and the businesses there. Graham's was mixed in with that whole money laundering operation, even though it was off of airport grounds. So putting all these pieces together, it's like, oh, hell yeah. If you're going to run an operation like this, Graham's would be the place to go to have these guys hang out.
Whoa. Okay. So,
you know, and you come up with some heavy stuff, Charlie, but when I said, yeah, Charlie would love this.
Yeah. Yeah. That's too much, man. That's too, I mean, I've heard some things in my day, but to have, you know, I mean, you hear that the Muhammad Atta called his dad the following day after 9/11 and his dad was like, he's fine. I don't know what to tell you. The whole thing stinks. Yeah. But so you put this, back to A Noble Lie here, because you put this movie out, and what is the response that you get? Because I remember the first time I heard of you and the movie was when you were promoting the movie, and I was like, whoa, what is this? I'm gonna have to go down this rabbit hole now, Oklahoma City bombing, it's been too long, you know, I should probably get into this. And I watched the movie and I'm just like, oh my God. And I remember you guys were out promoting like crazy. What was the response? Did people have a how dare you reaction, like you're just being disrespectful to the memories of these people? We've already determined what the story is, and now here you come. And
that's a great question. And I'm gonna preface, we went back 2 years before we even started shooting and doing the interviews. We had the outline, we had a pretty good idea what direction we wanted to move in. So for four weekends in a row, the Catholic Church, St. Joe's Cathedral, across the street from the memorial, had a big, it's an 18-foot statue of Jesus. And then there's 19 pillars commemorating, beautiful black granite pillars commemorating the deaths of the 19 children. And then I think there was four adults in the daycare. Anyway, the pastor of that church and the secretary, who oddly enough was injured the morning of the bombing, she's sitting there and debris flying into her window from across the street. And they said, we wanted to hand out a survey, just a quick 6-question survey. And out of those four weekends, we had 2,800 people. We asked questions, only five wanted us not to make the movie. And it's like, okay, really? We know what direction we're moving in.
Okay.
So to add that on, after the film was released in December 2011, 4 days before we released it, our entertainment lawyer brought us into his office. And he says, guys, one of two things is going to happen. He said, the Justice Department and the FBI is going to come down on you like a ton of bricks, or you're going to hear crickets. He says, there's not going to be anything in between. He saw the master rough cut, and it scared the hell out of him. He says, oh boy, watch out. Because he's dealt with other sensitive movies in the past. And he says, even though he's from Tulsa, he says, oh yeah, you're going to do great on this, or you're going to be hauled into court. Well, we told him right then and there, I said, look, with all due respect, you may not be aware of this. 95% of our documentation, the movie's based on, is of the federal government's own documents. There's no way in hell they're going to bring us into court. We'd kick them around like a soccer ball, and we'd call them out on their bluff on every single one of these documents. They were going to set themselves up to fail, and there was no way they were going to do that. So it's a loaded answer to your question, but they told, with the help, and I always, massive gratitude to InfoWars and Alex, what he did for us. He rolled out the red carpet. To this day, we'd still probably be an independent film crew that would, you know, getting by. But anyway, within 2.5 months, we sold 26,000 DVDs in 37 different countries. It took off. John B. Wells, you familiar with him as a radio show host?
I am.
First time he was on Caravan to Midnight, separate from George Norrie Network. we were on his first show, and out of Dallas. We had so many orders on his show for that new film. It was literally out for 6 weeks at that point, if that, maybe 4 weeks. PayPal, their server locked up for a half an hour. That's, I mean, it was like a firestorm. And John B. Wells is like, what are you guys doing? We're on commercial break. And he says, what the hell is going on? PayPal's blowing up my phone, you know? Anyway, so we were very blessed. We didn't take that for granted. And we were like a deer in the headlights, Charlie. We had no idea that we were going to get the response we did. But the fire department and the police department, we literally gave them, I think, at least 100 to 200 free DVDs each. And one of them they handed out. And, you know, the bike officers of the highway patrol were getting wind. And I'd run into them at a 7-Eleven. They said, can we have a copy? I says, oh, heck yeah. And sure enough, I'd go by the precinct and drop off 10, even though they asked for one. Can I share a story? One of his partners specifically came to a film festival in Dunklin, Oklahoma. It was one of our last ones that we were at. And it was the Trail Dance Film Festival. And we were selected as a finalist. He came behind the lecture hall at this community college. Capacity was maybe 65. We had 125 standing room only, out in the hallways with the doors open watching our film. He came up after me, and out of courtesy, after we're done, we had to make room for the next filmmaker in their station. He's there with his wife, his granddaughter in a wheelchair, and his two sons. And he gave me a bear hug.
Wow.
And started crying. And excuse me, but he was a junior bike officer at the time of the bombing. And he said, if it wasn't for your film, he said, I thought you'd be crazy. Anyway, but he thanked us for putting it together.
Damn. You know, we talk about these things and we expose these lies and we you know, because it matters. You know, it matters. We take a lot of heat from a lot of people that don't understand or don't want to, they think it's disrespectful.
Yeah.
But there are some people out there that they understand, they know, like, you've got to do what you do. If you don't tell this story now, we're going to relive it in some other form or fashion. It's, if it's Oklahoma City, you know, in 95, it's New York City in 2001, it's who knows where, you know, this year, next year, whatever. If we don't make the world aware of these tactics and who these people actually are, they will continue to get away with literally murdering people, murdering children, in the, because they need a body count to get legislation passed or to get enough, you know, to keep it in the news cycle long enough to get so-and-so reelected or get this guy out of office, or I've got to get my promotion to Washington. And we're supposed to pretend that this is normal human being behavior. These are psychopaths. These are dangerous individuals. And I worry about, I mean, all of us that are in this in some, you know, whatever capacity we're in it, because we understand these people don't like you talking about the things that they're doing, because if the general public knew what they were doing, they would rightly be incarcerated for their rest of their life, if not hanged at the town square by, a mob with torches and pitchforks, which is where it feels like this is going. So you make this movie, you get this reaction. How can you ever go back to a normal life after this, right? You've got to be on this for good. Like, this has got to be, this is it, man. This is what you're on this planet to do, right? To expose these guys, and you go on and you start making other films. And man, I mean, Shadow Ring, I had seen before. I watched it again. I recognize now I know a lot of the guys that are in the show, which is a trip this time around, you know, to watch
something.
We're still talking about the Council on Foreign Relations. We're still talking about people in position, you know, unelected government bureaucrats that are making the system work. I mean, how do you process all of this? Are you hungry to do more of this? Is it tough on your soul? Is it both?
Well, after the film was released, even before we released the first one, I was harassed on the job. We were tailed. nothing life threatening, but you know, it was brought to our attention in no uncertain terms that you know, we were going down the wrong path, according to, you know, the folks that individuals didn't want us to put the film out. But the reason I brought up the bike officer, Charlie, is that he had 8 different radio bands on his motorcycle, on his Harley that morning. He's literally parked 2 blocks away, just outside of the triage unit. And he heard all of the storylines coming across, and he knew that there were other perps, and they were told to stand down. And as a rookie, he says, no, that's just like Terry Ickey. He says, I'm not going to do this. And he kept telling his commanding officers, we need to investigate this. He almost got fired twice.
Wow.
I'm saying that is because if you're a filmmaker and you want to get into a subject that's touchy or whatever, don't back off. Just be smart about it. Stay focused. Keep your eye on the ball. Pursue what you want to do. And yeah, and it just, the feedback we got was 95% positive, 5% negative. And that's what inspired us to do our second film. It's like, okay, why weren't people smart enough to see that the official narrative was complete garbage? And then we did the State of Mind Psychology of Control, which is basically from the day you're born to the day you die, you're literally controlled in some form, whether it be nutrition, education, government edict, you know, laws, corruption. And there's going to be boulders. If you can, kind of an analogy is, you got these boulders flying down the side of the mountain. So how are you going to dodge these boulders every single day? You know, you're going to be smart. You're going to know when something falls in front of you, which direction to go, and how to decipher the information and make the next course of action. So our films were released not as an end-all be-all. Hell no, far from it. They're a primer. They're to give you a foundation of at least some solid information to give you, you know, how to formulate good decisions, responsible decisions, and then teach your kids how to do the same thing.
So. Yeah. Man. What was it like working with James Perloff? I've had him on before.
Oh, it was fun.
He's so funny. He's the best at delivering bad news to you, because he'll do it in such a fun, big smile on his face as he's telling you that the world is ending.
Well, even in the trailer, we're in post-production putting the trailer together, and it's like, wow, these are all golden nuggets from Perloff's interview. You know, which one do you drop out? James was doing a PowerPoint presentation. It was a 4-hour presentation at a kind of a truth activist, a patriot convocation in Midwest City, not far from the airbase, south of Oklahoma City. And it was James Lane, our executive director, that saw this presentation. He pulls James Perloff aside after everything was done, and they're wrapping things up, and he says, we want to make a movie on your presentation. And Perloff's like, what are you talking about? He says, it's 4 hours long. He says, no, James says, we're not doing a 4-hour film. He says, let's condense the best of the best out of this. And I have both books here that the movie's based on. It was Shadows of Power, mm-hmm. Which was a massive selling book. And then Truth is a Lonely Warrior. So yeah. The film is based on all of the first book and half of the second one. And by God, you know, probably one of the best guys that ever worked with in my experience. He was very patient with us. You know, no question is a dumb question, but some of ours were, you know, it was common sense to him. Just very matter of fact, very nice. And if I had an opportunity to bring him on another project, boom, he'd be on the short list right away. That's how much we enjoyed working with him.
Yeah, he's smart, and he's witty, and he makes it make sense. It's very logical whenever I hear him. And he's got a book, Tornado in a Junkyard, that's out as well.
I gotta read that one.
He was one of the first guests I had on Macroaggressions back when I started in 2020. And I reached out to the people who sort of inspired me a little bit, you know. I mean, maybe I could write a book too. Maybe I could do this. And then to see Shadow Ring, and I didn't see that until I must have seen that in 2018, I think.
Okay. Yeah, we released it in June of 2015, a couple of weeks after here from Oklahoma City. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's still, and then Kevin Sorbo, that's a funny story how we got him on. Mary Ellen Moore, one of my business partner and a co-executive producer of Shattering, her good friend, get this, was a head of merchandising for Mel Gibson on the Passion of Christ. Mm-hmm. And got a really lucrative contract, not with Paramount, pissed off Paramount, but went with another operation. And also did the merchandising for the Hercules Legendary Journeys for Kevin Sorbo. So she knew Kevin years ago. And Kevin was just coming on, and he could correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he'd only been finding out what's really going on behind the scenes with the government about a year before we asked him to come on. So we sent him half the script. We weren't even finished with the script, and James Perloff's like, yeah, let's send this to Kevin. Once, you know, his eyes lit up, he says, oh, heck yeah, let's get him on. Kevin calls me from the produce aisle of a Trader Joe's in East Hollywood. It's like Westlake Village. And he says, I'm in. He says, Kevin, we're not even halfway through. He says, no, I love it. I want to read. And I says, all right, just be patient. We'll get you the rest of the script. So that was in March of 2014. And it was in September of that year that we were able to hire out a voiceover studio in L.A. And we had him in studio for 2 days, and he knocked it out of the park. Did a wonderful job for us. Super nice guy to work for. So.
And he's turned into quite an outspoken, one of the few outspoken Hollywood actors that seems to see what's going on. It's an unusual group of them too. It's like Rob Schneider from all the Adam Sandler movies, and Kevin Sorbo, and you're like, this is looks like who's this cast? This isn't the Expendables. This is like the extras or something. You know, I mean, guys that you wouldn't really but you know, they see something, they see it from a different angle, and we certainly do appreciate that. Well, what about Free Mind Films? What are you guys doing?
There are actually three projects in works right now. Charlie, thank you for asking. I had a pre-production meeting earlier today. We talked about this before we went live. It's dealing with January 6th. That's all I can say right now. But once we are able to reveal the details and get all the I's dotted and the T's crossed, you're going to be one of you and Ricky and a short list of others will be the first to know.
Awesome.
In fact, I want to say this, if I may, I'm going to do a shout out to Paul Wittenberger, who did COVIDland. I was literally on with him at 3:30 this afternoon, Eastern time. And he did an amazing review of Shadow Ring last night. He emailed me the link on Rockfin. We are going to embed that on our website because people, believe it or not, there's still a market for DVDs. Paul is selling our DVDs of our films, of State of Mind and Shadow Ring. So he really dissected it, did a great review, and I want to thank Paul for that and the outstanding job he did on COVIDland. COVIDland series, the Mickey Willis and his, his films.
Plandemic.
And then Plandemic. And who produced Died Suddenly? He was at the awards.
Stu Peters?
Yes. Between those three, I mean, it's game over. It's, if anybody still believes the official COVID narrative after watching those series of films, then you've really got some serious problems. So you're beyond reproach. Anyway, I wanted to give a shout out to him and thank him for doing that amazing review of Shattering. We're going to embed that on our website. I should have it up within the next week. So as you scroll down, you'll see the interview I had with Owen Schroyer regarding Merrick Garland, who was in studio in July of last year at InfoWars. And we're going to have Paul's review of Shattering and encourage people to go there if they want the DVD copies. So
awesome. And the best place to find your work, to support what you're doing is
Free Mind Films with an S, freemindfilms.com. Anybody want, I'm not on social media anymore. I know that sounds old school, but we just got pummeled, Charlie, for 5 years. We had so many pirated profiles and, you know, duplicate bullcrap profiles, and we just didn't want to deal with it anymore. They can get a hold of me. If anybody wants to contact me, have any questions or any up and coming filmmakers, I'll try to lead you in the right direction. It's Chris Emery, excuse me, take that back. CC Emery, CCEMERY at protonmail.com. And I'll be happy to help you with any of your questions.
That's Chris Emery, everybody. He is making the most important films of our generation. I encourage you to support his work to the extent that you can. At the very least, share it with people around you. Chris, thank you so much. I appreciate you a great deal.
And I'm sorry for getting emotional earlier, but recalling, it's like a memory recall, Charlie, all of these things that happened. And that bike officer was amazing.
So, we understand. Well, let me rephrase that. We'll never understand. You know, we could never really understand this. We'll do our best to try and make sure that we don't forget about this. And for those of you that want to connect with me, the website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can follow me on Twitter at macroaggressions. If you like this episode, take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you again soon.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.